Welcome to The Eminence Project. In this series, I share raw, real conversations with people who ignite my soul, clients, friends, experts, who have faced their challenges head on and risen stronger by choosing themselves. I'm Bryony Lieber. To be eminent is to shine. Join me to step into your brilliance. In 2025, I found out in the weirdest way that I have ADHD. It was a huge surprise to me, but it was also something that made a lot of sense to me. And a couple months after that, I published a blog sharing with the world that I have ADHD. And lo and behold, out of that blog came 8 different friends who all said, "Me too, Bryony." One of those friends was Lynn Caton, who's in studio with me today. Lynn, welcome.
Very pleased to be here and thanks for having me.
So ADHD, we found this out relatively recently in both of our instances with late diagnoses in our 50s. It was a big surprise for me. Was it a big surprise for you?
It was not really. I had a sense for many years, well, going back into my 30s even, that I may be ADHD, but it was always seen as a bit of a lighthearted joke, character quirk, etc.
I would love to explore what led you to go and find out if you had ADHD. In my instance, it came out of quite a traumatic burnout experience that put me into hospital for 3 weeks. And it was in kind of the first week of being in hospital that the psychiatrist asked me a lot of questions and at some point said to me, "I think you need to try this medication, and if it works, you're going to feel really good. But if it doesn't work, you're going to be hyper anxious, and this is the right place to be if that's going to happen." And a couple hours after I took what, and I didn't know what medication I was taking, but a couple hours after I took it, I was sitting in his office and I said to him, "You know when you've got those paper cutout dolls that we used to have as little kids and you kind of concertina them out and they're kind of 20 of the same dolls? Well, I feel like all of those dolls have concertinaed back in and it's just one doll. And they're all looking in the same direction, speaking with the same voice, thinking the same thing. They're acting in concert with each other." And it was the most magnificent feeling. And I couldn't remember having had that feeling in a very long time, if ever. And when I explained that to him, he said, "Well, that confirms it. You've got ADHD. So how did you find out, Lynn?
So what prompted me to get the diagnosis was out of curiosity. As I'd said just now, I'd suspected it, but didn't really think specifically to go and get a diagnosis. I mean, what's that going to help? And then somebody I worked with in her 40s went and got a diagnosis, and it got me thinking. Thought, well, I didn't know actually, quite frankly, that it's something you do in your 40s or 50s, go and get assessed for something like ADHD.
No, me neither.
Yeah. So I was curious. I thought, you know, at least just go and find out. Really, I thought it was more of a quirk than anything. I expected her to say yes, but thought, well, there you go. I can say I told you. And so I did it. I just went in and saw the same psychologist who specializes in ADHD. I think they ask you 18 questions, and I checked every single one.
Me too.
Which that surprised me. And I didn't realize how much of my makeup was underpinned by ADHD tendencies and limitations, if you want to call it that, because I have always just pushed through. Just pushed through, deliver, perform, be reliable, get things done. So it was this, I think my ability to perform and achieve to a large extent had masked or disguised the ADHD.
I've coached quite a number of people with ADHD. I didn't know I had ADHD at the time, but I could certainly see a lot of traits where they'd be talking about something and go, yeah, that feels familiar, but this is how I deal with it. And I'd coach them on and kind of share some thoughts on how to deal with it. Never thinking, oh, I must have ADHD. I'd spent my entire life hearing stigmas around ADHD, hearing people say, you would never have ADHD, you're too bright, you're too competent, you've been too successful, you're too reliable, you are so structured, you are so insanely good at focusing and getting things done, that there's no way in hell you would ever have ADHD. And I just never really even considered it. But when I learned about my diagnosis, validation, you used the word validation. There was definitely a sense of, maybe the validation has come later. There was a sense of relief of, I finally feel like I belong to a tribe. I feel like I now know where I fit in the world, because I've spent my entire life not feeling like I fit, not feeling like I belong. And that for me has probably been the huge relief in all of this. And I think something that really struck me, so when I published this blog about my ADHD, you and 8 other people that I know well came out of the woodworks and all said, thank you for publishing that. Thank you for having the courage to talk about this. I've had ADHD for 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. I've never talked about it. I don't know how to talk about it. And that for me was a big surprise. So I want to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so I remember that conversation really well. And I think I was definitely one of those who was surprised. And I think you were surprised about me.
Very much so.
Because the world only sees what we show.
Yeah.
The world doesn't see what's going on inside our minds and what we've been struggling with. And critically, I think for somebody who lives with ADHD and is perceived as successful, is we've learned how to mask and how to disguise any weakness picked up from a young age, that you're not supposed to behave in a certain way. You're supposed to be seen as being valuable, helpful, and spending a lifetime building that persona very effectively meant the world only saw the kind of hyper opposite side of you. Really capable, very reliable, very resourceful. And these things are all true, but it's this persona that you create to be seen as valuable. So I think just learned very early on to be valuable, and not to, if you pick up once that a certain behavior or attitude is unhelpful or seen as undesirable, the shame that goes with that is a shame you don't want to ever experience twice. So you say to yourself, even as a very young girl, can't be letting anybody else see that side of me again. We don't have the language for that at the time, but it's what you do. You put together this best possible, indispensable version of yourself, and that becomes very valuable in the workspace. And I don't know about you, but a large part of my identity was formed around my ability to perform.
I can resonate with that 100%. Everything about my identity has been about how to perform, about how to be valuable, about how to belong, about how to fit into boxes that now that I'm starting to unpack those boxes, I don't even know how I ever fitted into them in the first place. But I'm trying to think of some of the things that I suppressed in my early years. And immediately what comes to mind is being really boisterous and full of kind of loud joy, running around kind of heavy-footed, singing at the top of my voice, and really being this big, loud presence and being told, you need to quieten down a lot. And I'm looking at your face. That seems to resonate.
Did any adult in your life ever say to you, children should be seen and not heard?
All the time. And I don't know if that's an ADHD thing or if that's just a generation.
It's a generational thing, but I think for somebody who has, and I'm sure we'll dive into this a bit more during our discussion, but is this thing about rejection sensitivity disorder, RSD as it's known. And I think because, again, we're susceptible to that very early on, I kind of knew that, my father didn't really mean that, But part of me kind of thought, maybe he does. Maybe I should. So what happens is you shrink yourself and make yourself compliant, make yourself the kind of child people want to have around.
Mm.
And yeah, that's just a small example of the type of thing that lives with you into adulthood, even the sense of, so I'm exact. In fact, my response is complete opposite of yours. I restrain a lot of myself to fit in. I have an ability, whether it's good or bad, but to take on like chameleon like qualities. So I can be boisterous with boisterous people. I can be reserved with reserved people. I blend into the crowd that I'm with.
I'm smiling because I can resonate with that. At one stage, I prided myself in having about 7 or 8 different groups of friends, none of whom had ever met each other because every single group of friends had completely different characteristics. And in each group, I could fit in perfectly if I presented a sliver of myself. And I remember bringing a large number of them together at one particular birthday. And then suddenly realizing what a huge mistake I'd made, because suddenly I had to be all the slices of my own pie. And all of these different people were in the same space. I started to kind of wonder, how on earth do I sustain this? How do I be boisterous with them, quiet with them, intellectual with them? I don't know where to be. There wasn't enough wallpaper on the wall for me to hide into. And it was a terrifying experience, but it was one of the first times where I started to think there's something wrong with me and I must be a bit of an imposter because I can be this with that person and that with a completely different person.
And yet, as you were saying, it's a sliver of yourself. So it's not like you're being insincere or...
Never.
Not being genuine. You just are a different part of you.
Yes.
Feels comfortable in that space.
Yes.
So there's certain environments in which, and I now speak for myself, where I would be bold. In fact, the boldness would surprise me. This ability to speak up and do things. I'm going like, wow, couldn't have seen myself doing that before. And I certainly wouldn't have done it with a different group of people. And yet there it is. So I think... Personally, I enjoy having a variety, the same as you, of groups of friends that I can be that version of myself with for what I need. You know, if I need to have some quiet time, I know who to go with. If I need to have some physical, like running type expression, then I've got people to do that with. But it's strange. I don't know about you, Bryony, but then, you know, you have to ask yourself at some point, so who am I really?
But and that's exactly it. And that's the scary question is, who am I really? Who am I today versus who was I yesterday? If they can be different versions of me, who am I really at the end of the day? And it's a scary question because you're asking about your own identity.
I agree with you. And I think that is very much part of the journey of ADHD post-diagnosis is understanding yourself and understanding how much of yourself you have suppressed in different circumstances and giving yourself time to actually embrace your full self. And it starts with asking these questions and realizing doesn't mean because you're different with different groups of people that actually isn't the whole of you.
Yeah.
Just different representations.
I'm glad you're talking about this journey from diagnosis because I really do think, and what I'm experiencing at the moment is this whole identity shift and this identity confusion. Before my diagnosis, my identity was, I am hyperproductive. You can give me a list of 30 things and I will tick them all off in one day. I will get a whole bunch of other things done as well. I am a workhorse and I can work for hours and hours and hours. The flip side of that identity was I've burnt out several times in my life, but that was my identity, was work is what makes me kind of who I am and I'm really good at it and I don't stop. Now, post my diagnosis, I'm starting to find myself being less and less productive and berating myself because I'll have maybe 3 things on my list for the day and I'm struggling to get through 1. And yet at the same time, I'm getting good rest. I'm taking time for myself. I'm fitting in time for exercise. I'm fitting in kind of time for conversations. I'm far more balanced. But there's this identity kind of question around, but is this who I am? What happened to this version of me that was so productive? And what is it costing me if I let go of that version? There's also the question of, what am I gaining as I let go of that version?
I've experienced that too, and I think this is part of the idea of what typically happens when you are diagnosed late, is that you spent your entire life conforming to other people's expectations for sake of being accepted or being seen as valuable. So you don't really, and because, I don't know about you, but I'm like, my brain doesn't stop. It's go, go, go. And I'm either physically doing one thing and next thing, or at least if I am standing still, my brain still doesn't stop. So never learned to pause for a moment and just reflect and regroup. And what happened with me is a part of what brought about, I suppose, the late diagnosis was also an element of burnout, funny enough. And I firmly put this in the court of menopause.
Mm-hmm.
I think I wasn't working at any different pace to what I had been working my entire life. But I think what happened with menopause is it reduced my ability to continue at that pace. And so my output began exceeding the rate at which I could replenish my energy. And as a result, I burned out. What happened as a result of the burnout is that I was no longer able to do things the way I wanted to and meet the standard that I'd set for myself, and the shame that came with that, and that sense that I was going to be found out, because up till now I've put on this very capable, very together exterior, which in hindsight I realized now was a mask. It was for the benefit of everybody else to be seen as valuable. And when I could not, that mask started developing cracks, that fear and shame that people are going to see the real version of me that I've very viciously protected from the world, it was suddenly, it's like the emperor with no clothes.
Yeah.
Completely laid bare for the world to see, and I felt so vulnerable and so exposed. But that said, I am so glad that happened. So my diagnosis was probably 3 or 4 years ago, and I've done quite a lot of inner healing, self work since then. And I can look back now and say, I'm actually so glad that happened, because it ultimately led me to feeling like I could give myself permission to no longer feel like I need to be all things to all people, and that I could actually really start thinking about who I really am. I do sense that there's been growth, and I no longer feel that immense pressure to perform, be all things to all people. And I think in a funny way, this is why I say it's linked to menopause stage of life. It's part of nature's way of taking us into the next season. And it's unpleasant when you're going through it, but in the long run, I think it's healthy and it's more sustainable.
Yeah. And it's, I think it leads to a version of oneself that I want to say I'm far more comfortable with. You were talking about the shame of not being enough. And when you were saying that, what immediately was popping to my mind was also the shame of being too much, and the shame of burning out, and now the shame of not getting enough done. And no matter where you kind of look, there seems to be this shame that goes with you. My most recent experience of shame has been, I'm perpetually late for things, which never used to be a problem for me. I always used to be perpetually early for things. Now I'm finding that I look at a 25-minute gap and I go, oh, I can fit something into that 25 gap. Yes, I can learn French, or I can put together an entire coaching program. But I look at that 25-minute gap differently. I used to look at that and go, there is no way in hell I can get this task done, so I'm not even going to start it. Somebody said to me, you should try the 5-minute rule. You give yourself 5 minutes to get started on something. And if you get absorbed in it, keep going with it. If after 5 minutes it's not catching on, give it up and try it again another day. Well, I'm finding it's catching on. I'm suddenly starting to get admin tasks done that I never used to be able to get done because that's what I fit into those 25-minute gaps.
So I was actually, if I say in everything you've just said, the complete opposite. But the commonality is my relationship with and understanding of time. So in my case, you've known me long enough to know that I'm always late.
Always losing time.
I'm always late, always late. And the diagnosis gave me reason. I was able to understand why. You know, I was able to be just a lot more kinder to myself and to stop beating myself up. I think that one of the really beautiful things is that once I'd got the diagnosis so much made sense to me and I was able to understand what some of my, call it impairments, deficits, whatever it was, things that I've lived with or just assumed were quirks, were actually underpinned by a neurodivergent brain.
Mm.
Once I was able to process it, it actually set me free in a way because now I understand this idea of time blindness. And I understand that it's a real thing. I'm not imagining it. And I've had to learn new techniques and new tools to compensate for that. Whereas before, it was just, I'm sorry, I'm late. You know, I was just now, it's going to be late. It's like I couldn't help it.
Mm.
And now I know that I'm bound to be late and it's wired into me. And the only way I'm going to offset that is by getting way more vigilant about the way I run my calendar and my planning.
Mm.
And I have got a whole lot better.
So it's so interesting that you're going in that direction. Mm. I've become so much less vigilant. I used to be hyper-vigilant. But for me, what this diagnosis has offered to me is an acceptance of I don't have to always get things done. I don't have to always be so structured with myself and so unforgiving of myself. And so there's so many things that I've used over the course of my life to compensate for the way my brain works that I didn't even know how my brain works. And I think that's the other thing. That's been so people talk about how grief comes up when you learn about having ADHD. That for me is being part of the grieving process is I'm only finding out now who I am. And so when people say to you, you're not being authentic, there's a part of me that goes, how could I be authentic? I didn't know who I was. I truly didn't know what was true for me because I couldn't make sense of certain things that I did and why those were unacceptable and why they just felt so natural to me.
There's so much there that I'm trying to pick up on some of the things that you'd said that I wanted to elaborate on. You know, when you speak about your relationship with time and how you see it differently now, I think one of the values of having a diagnosis is it gives you a language. It gives you a language to see how you've approached time consciously or unconsciously in one way. And you're, again, with a late diagnosis and menopause-related, hormone-related, it's like it strips away all your mechanisms that you used for propping yourself up and being so efficient, and then that gets stripped away without you having any control over it, and you're left so vulnerable. And as a result, you either, my experience has been, you either embrace it and accept it and adjust to the new version of you, whatever that is, or you try desperately to cling on to that old version of you for the sake of, I don't know, for other people's benefit, I don't know. But it doesn't work because you're never going to go back to being that person. Mm. And that, for me, was so liberating when I realized, you know what, at least now I know what I'm dealing with.
Mm.
And I had to simply go out and learn new tools, new techniques, new ways of navigating life, but now knowing what I know.
Mm.
So it was, in fact, once I'd got over, you speak about the grief, once I had come to terms with the enormity of what ADHD actually is, and I was able to regroup and pick up the pieces and move forward, I realized that it actually really was so much of a gift, because I've been able to release myself from so much unfair expectation, and my inner peace is so much stronger, if that's the right word.
Mm.
But my inner dialogue somehow is not as bad as it used to be.
Yeah, that's completely makes sense to me. I've had this massive inner critic for as long as I can remember, exasperated Sally. She's that voice who's constantly going, "Oh God, Bryony, are you still thinking that you're good enough to do this? Are you still trying to do this?" Big sigh. And she has, by and large, started to disappear.
Mm.
Because there's so much more of me that I'm starting to just accept and starting to actually be playful with and love and actually nurture. So I absolutely think having this diagnosis is a gift. I was reading a while ago that the relationship between burnout and undiagnosed ADHD is potentially really strong. So the grief for me is, I wish 10 years ago when I first burnt out that somebody had said to me, maybe this is undiagnosed ADHD. Maybe we need to look at that. I also wish 10 years ago somebody had said to me, maybe you're starting perimenopause. Oh, and yes, these two things are overlapping. And perhaps that's what we're seeing here, is these things. And there's a completely different way to deal with what's presenting as burnout. When I burnt out last year, that was at this kind of nexus of some traumatic experiences that I was going through in my business and in a relationship. Perimenopause, as at the absolute height of my perimenopause, rejection sensitivity dysphoria, because I was on a daily basis feeling like I was being hit in the chest with a concrete block every single day. The most enormous kind of rejection I was feeling on a daily basis, and not having the capacity to process that, not having the tools to process that. And so when I landed up in hospital and somebody said, here's a label, I just grabbed onto that label because it suddenly started to make sense of things. But what was really scary for me was how many people in kind of the last 6 months said, Bryony, since you had an ADHD diagnosis, you've gotten worse. You're scatterbrained, you're late, you're disorganized, you become really introverted. You're doing all these things that aren't you. Are you sure this diagnosis isn't the problem? And I've had to deal with a lot of those things, because actually I've come to realize I am an introvert. I just put on a lot of kind of life and soul of the party because that's how I made myself comfortable in large social situations. I went to a talk a couple months ago. There was a panel discussion on neurodiversity in the workplace. And these five different panel members were talking about things that they do. They all had ADHD. And the one panelist says, I hate writing or kind of typing. I get through that by speaking to my computer. And I went, I've done that for a long time. I didn't know that was kind of why I was doing this. And then somebody else said, I block my time. And I try and kind of put all of these things into one kind of time block, because otherwise I can't get anything done. Like, I do that too. And funnily enough, you and I talked a long, probably at the beginning of this year, about body doubling. And in this panel discussion, somebody said, I body double. And for anybody who doesn't know what body doubling is, it's basically making sure that you've got someone in the room with you, whether it's in person or virtual. Because as someone with, and I, you can explain this better than me, Lynn, but for me, working by myself is like torture. I don't need to be working with someone. I need to have someone in the room with me. We don't have to talk. We don't have to be working on the same thing. We don't even have to know anybody. But I love working in coffee shops because of the background noise and the people. And so when you and I started doing this virtual body doubling, I can't tell you how productive those two-hour sessions make me. I get things done that I cannot for the life of me get done if we're not in a body doubling session.
I agree with you. It's really effective. So, I mean, you could do body doubling. It doesn't even have to be a live person. There's YouTube videos where if you want to clean your house, you put on a YouTube video of somebody else cleaning their house as a body doubler, and you play the YouTube video and you just feel like there's somebody sharing that. It's a psychological connection of sorts. It's so silly because it's actually, especially if it's a recorded thing, it's nothing. It just something in your brain feels like I'm not alone in this.
Yeah.
And this is more fun. I think it's probably something to do with dopamine. You know, we want to be part of something that inspires us, motivates us. So something from the exterior that's giving us some kind of impetus. I've struggled to find people who are willing to body double. I don't know if you've done that with anyone else as well. I do it with you and one other person. And also that person has said the same thing. So effective. That sense of being able to just, I don't know, somehow that maybe it's a time blindness thing where you realize there's a confined period. You only have that half an hour or hour, whatever it is. And suddenly it becomes, maybe it's an urgency that kicks in with that. So, you know, as opposed to, as I find, if there's an open ended, it can be done anything, and there's no accountability if it doesn't happen, it can just slip to the bottom of the pile.
I mean, it may be a combination of those two, but long before I heard about body doubling, I used to have a soundtrack called Coffee Shop Sounds, and it was literally sounds of people kind of with a mug. Yeah. You can now hear my mug in the room, and kind of background chatter, and I used to play those.
Yes.
And when I first started kind of 9 years ago working at home on my own, I used to play these background soundtracks, and I couldn't play music because I can't concentrate with music on, but a background track of coffee shop noises.
It's other humans.
And I'd forgotten about that until you said to me, do you want to do some body doubling sessions? What are some of the other things that you've learned to embrace?
So I would have to say the most important area for me has been around time blindness, mm-hmm. and understanding, or getting better at understanding, the passage of time. One of the tools that I found really helpful is this understanding of transitioning from one activity to the other. Whereas before, my diary would be jam-packed one thing to the other. And somehow or other, I went through life being able to mostly get that right, which is maybe why I was generally 3 or 5 minutes late for everything, because I was transitioning, but I hadn't put the transitioning time in my calendar. Mm. So practically, I mean, it sounds so obvious. I don't know how I didn't do this, but to factor in enough time for physically getting from one activity to the next. I've actually now put white time in my diary for that, where I know it's going to take X amount of time to pack up what I'm doing now, pack up for the next thing, and get there. That's like three things. I had to learn how to break that down into steps. It sounds so juvenile, but, and for somebody who comes to naturally, it goes like, really? And you said you did well, you know, up until this point. But it's just understanding. So, and that's what I've had to do. I've had to learn that time has a cost. This idea of opportunity cost of time. That if I'm going to be spending that time talking to a friend where I should have been packing up my bags to go to the next place, that time's not going to replace itself. It's gone.
Yeah.
You know, it sounds so basic, but this is something I had to get intentional about. So, and that's been helpful, as obvious as it seems. The other thing is to actually factor in decompression time. I've got a day with 2 or 3 really busy, intellectually demanding activities. In my ripe old age, I now put in buffer time after that time to recover, to find my energy level again before I even start packing my bags and moving to the next thing. I've just given myself a wide berth to understand, use the time in a way. So it's like a form of developing an accommodation for yourself. Sometimes you speak about neurodiversity in the workplace. Sometimes all that person needs is to be able to wear their headphones, yeah, or to be given, in principle, at least 24 hours notice for a meeting, mm-hmm, to be able to prepare themselves. So in my case, I started identifying what accommodations I need. And one of them is that I limit the amount of time that I commit, either one-on-one or in a coaching session, in a group, whatever it is. If I'm having to participate in time with other humans, because it's funny, I'm ambivert, both, mm-hmm, introverted and extroverted. So I get my energy from that space, but it also depletes me.
Mm-hmm.
So what I've learned now is get the energy from that space, but I give myself a good half an hour afterwards to decompress and just, it's like the battery recharges.
Yeah.
So I've factored in battery recharge time in my diary now. And that's an accommodation that I realized I needed myself. And it's made all the difference. So now I don't feel I have to achieve four major things every day. I can do two or three, and some days one. But on the whole, I make sure that I no longer pack as much as I can into the day.
It makes so much sense to me. And I somehow, having an ADHD diagnosis has given me permission to do exactly what you're talking about. I used to get to work at 7 o'clock in the morning and sometimes only leave at 8 or 9 o'clock at night because I'd packed so many things into the day. And now I'm finding that I have what I call potato days, and it's not D-A-Y-S, it's D-A-Z-E. I go into this kind of absolute exhaustion where I can't think. I literally feel like I'm a potato. And I can now see that happens without fail after I've had two or three days of pure hyperfocus. The struggle with that is you can't predict it, although I'm getting better at being able to self-regulate so that I have less potato days. But in those moments when that hyperfocus comes up and you really just want to harness it because it is so beautiful, because all the thinking is happening and it's like you are this magical being, and nobody wants to lose those moments of being this just magical, creative, productive, on fire being. But if I let that run too long, I can crash for 2 or 3 days. The point that I'm trying to make is, this isn't new to me. I've always had ADHD, but before I knew about it, I would keep working at that pace for weeks and weeks and weeks. And then on the day that I was finished kind of working at that pace, I would crash and I'd be completely useless. And it would come at the cost of life. So it came at the cost of my marriage, it came at the cost of my friendships, it came at the cost of my physical health. The only way I could fill up my battery again, I thought, was by literally zoning out on the couch and not engaging in the world at all. What I've learned since then is actually my battery fills up with some socializing, with some engaging in life, with exercising, with doing all the things that I used to cut out of my life so that I could completely focus and work endless numbers of hours.
So this is in part the role that I believe menopause plays in this process, is that it simply strips you of the way you've always done things permanently.
So whether
it's not,
had
it's not a phase.
Yeah.
Menopause isn't a phase. It's not, you know, it's a new version of you. This old version is gone. New version of you is different. A lot of the things, your abilities and mechanisms and tools that you used depended on certain aspects of, you know, intrinsic qualities that were premenopausal, which are never going to come back.
Mm-hmm.
So this ability to look that monster in the face, but understand what it is and say, okay, in order for me to move forward, I need to know that I'm not going to be able to retrieve an old version of me.
I don't want to.
Well, that's the other thing I was going to, I have a question for you on that, is making, understanding what this new dynamic is and making the most of it. And this is post-diagnosis where you actually get to see the real you.
Mm.
It takes a while to work out who the real you is, but it's there. And having the diagnosis gives you the language and the lens to challenge assumptions, question certain things that you believed, and start again, in essence. Accept that you don't gaslight yourself and say, well, that wasn't really me, or I didn't really do those things, or maybe I was, I had skills I didn't think I had, or I just, somehow I was able to do things that were just, you can't explain now, but you actually have to, I've lost my train of thought.
That never happens.
No, never. So you have to go back to basics and know that that version of you was real and true and full, but it's a large part of who you were and what you had to work with is no longer there. So, and that's liberating in a way.
Yeah.
Because now you get to say, okay, I know my deep core values and the things I've always stood for, and those things are still important to me. So how am I going to live to those values now that I know what I know? And this is where I found the diagnosis so liberating, because I realized I'm not going mad.
Mm.
There was a reason that I was no longer feeling myself and that I was no longer able to do the things I used to be able to do. And I stopped beating myself up and realizing, okay, now at least I know what I'm working with, and it's an exploration process, but there's a way forward. Once you get past the shock and the grief and the denial and the confusion. But eventually, and this is what I'm saying, your true character is still there, because it eventually does pick up the pieces. You manage to pick the pieces up together again, and this is a different version of, but the original pieces are still there, just configured differently.
I like what you're saying, and I think my take on it is absolutely that there's always been this core self. No matter what part of life, and no matter whether there's been an ADHD diagnosis or not, as women, before perimenopause, menopause sets in, there was this, for me, there was this self that was me, but there was a layer on top of it that related to, this is how I need to be in order to stay safe and stay accepted and stay in the tribe and be loved. And not get kicked out or shamed or embarrassed. So there's this very core part of me plus this outer kind of part of me that keeps me safe.
That's what I was saying, is your disguise or your mask or your camouflage, whatever people want to call it. There's this version of you that you present to the world, and it's not conscious.
Yes.
I think that's where the confusion is.
Yeah.
Is that you believe that version of you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Until menopause strips it away.
Exactly. So my experience has been, as I've gotten closer and closer to menopause, it's kind of stripped away this need to be accepted, and the enormous amount of shame that's come up around no longer trying to please everybody. And last year was the pinnacle of, I'm trying to please everybody, it's not working, and I'm now going to show my emotions, and I'm going to react to this instead of going, oh, okay, I'll be this good girl who can just overcompensate for this. And so a lot of what happened last year was this very volatile version of me came out, and it was ugly, and it was scary, and it was repellent, and there was huge amounts of shame around that. And in the course of this year, starting to grapple with this label of ADHD and starting to make sense of it, all of that volatility is slowly dissipating. But along with that has been this kind of, this facade of, that I've had to maintain my entire life. And so the core part of me is here, and the core part of me is also becoming my exterior. And that for me is the beauty of all of us. It actually, I can feel I'm getting goosebumps just talking about this, because that for me is this huge gift of menopause and ADHD is suddenly being able to release this enormous amount of walls and pressure to be something and to now just be.
And that's what I was saying is part of the healing process.
Yes.
Because that doesn't happen within 2 weeks of your diagnosis. My experience is it takes a while for the reality to set in terms of what this means. In my case, I actually didn't really know, to be honest with you, what ADHD really was. ADHD really was, I just thought it was a little bit of forgetfulness or, you know, lack of concentration or like some silly behaviors. But once I started, because my nature is to go and do deep dives and research, and once I understood what ADHD actually was, it was almost like I wish I could have actually undone that diagnosis and like wish I didn't know these things. I'm like, I don't want to be that. And then you go into the denial, like, okay, no, I'm not that. And you start thinking back and thinking, no, actually that really was, I do have that. And that is a thing for me. I just didn't realize that that's not everybody's experience. And it explains so much. And I think my experience is quite normal. Once you have had an opportunity to explore what this thing really is and how it has impacted you actually your whole life without you knowing, and you take some time out to understand this dynamic, the grief comes in twofold. That loss of that sense of, well, what could have been if I'd known earlier? Not that I've got any regrets. I've had a very charmed life in so many ways, but in terms of things that I might have taken on or attempted if I wasn't holding myself back so much, I think that's the thing. I held myself back a lot for the sake of not wanting to be shamed or rejected or, you know, so I spent a lot of my life just living a version of myself that I could contain, I suppose. I don't know how else to put it. But so there was that grief of looking back and going, wow, I wonder what else I could have achieved if I was living my full self, if I'd known all these things about myself, or if I'd been medicated from a younger age or something, you know, just being able to explore the full version of you. I felt like I'd, you know.
And this comes from someone who's achieved a lot.
why is there this pressure to, again, going back to exactly. This, probably going like, oh, I should have achieved more. But that sense of what could have been possible, so that there's an element of regret, but it's crazy because it's something that wasn't there anyway. So you're grieving something that wasn't there but might have been there.
I think for me the grief is I didn't have the language to be able to explain what was going on with me.
Mm.
So, for instance, I can sometimes get into a conversation where I'm really animated and I'm very in the conversation. And then I'll get to a point where I suddenly start to lose my words and I start to lose concentration and I can't stay in the conversation. Before I had this ADHD language, I would push through the conversation and then I would hear myself saying things that were completely nonsensical. And I'd feel really embarrassed and I would double down and try and make more sense, which just was exhausting. And then I'd watch people literally try and slide out of the conversation because I was probably being too much. Now, with this language, I can notice I get to that point and I can very easily say, you know what? I'm starting to lose my words. I'm going to cut this conversation now. I'd love to pick this up with you again tomorrow, next week, next year, or never. But I can actually pinpoint all sorts of things where now I can make the choice to go, okay, this is where I'm stopping. Whereas before, my language was, I just need to push through and somehow it'll all become right. And it very rarely did.
And that's an example of an accommodation. Of accommodating your wants and needs because you understand them better now and you know what that feels like and what the alternative is. So being able to give yourself the space you need because it's good for both parties, again, it starts with awareness. And so this goes to the other side of the grief that I was saying, is this the sense of looking forward and going, it's like part of me was going, I wish I didn't know. I wish I'd been. How am I going to live with this? I can't undo this knowledge. And I was so overwhelmed by understanding what the how much of who I was actually built out of survival and not necessarily good things. But yet it's part of me, and going, well, how am I going to move forward with knowing partly that I don't have the things that I had a few years ago before the ADHD started revealing itself, but also not knowing my full self and how do I move forward? So that moment of grief of, it's actually, do you know what? You grieve yourself. You grieve the version of you that you thought you knew is no longer there, is never going to be back. And having to navigate life going forward without that version of you is quite overwhelming, and it's not even a conscious thing. Your internal mind is just trying to make sense of this discomfort and this painful. It's painful.
It is painful, but I also want to add to that. I'm starting to find it's quite exciting. I'm finding a lot of excitement in getting to know myself, in getting to let go of all the things that were pure functional survival and actually embrace the parts of myself that thrive when I allow those parts of myself to show up fully and unfiltered. Yeah, I mean, it's...
I agree with you completely. And that, but my point was that grief is not something you anticipate.
Yeah.
Look, you could spend the rest of your life feeling sorry for yourself. Thankfully, I don't think either of us is the type that's going to do that. But it's actually going, okay, once you understood it, you start it by nature working with what you have. And like you say, that liberation of realizing actually you've been set free. So it's like, now you've got this freedom. What do you do with it? Because you still need to work with what you have, but now you know what it is.
Mm.
It's like, it's the four stages of learning, I feel, comes into this as well. You know, first you didn't know what you didn't know. Now you do know. And then you have to start building on your new knowledge.
Yeah.
And eventually it becomes your full self comes into this being again, your new way of being in a real complete way that is healthy, and you can grow with it. So it is definitely a journey. And I suppose everyone's different. I would say it took me 2.5 to 3 years before I felt properly, like I had no regrets for having had the diagnosis. It was like it opened up a new door that for a long time I wish I'd never opened. I don't know if you ever had that.
I had that for a short period of time, and it comes up once in a while. But I think I've been quite lucky in that when I wrote that blog and all these people popped up and went, me too, I suddenly had a ready-made tribe. And I suddenly started to experience what it's like to be with people who just speak the same language as me and just get me. I don't have to explain myself. And the kind of the nervous system calm from being surrounded by people who just get me is something that I haven't experienced much of, because and you're nodding your head, and I hope anybody who's listening to this with ADHD is resonates with how much energy goes into explaining yourself to people who are going, why on earth would you do it like that? Why would you think like that? Why would you be late for that? Why would you be whatevering it is that they're commenting on? And I'm going, I don't know. This is just how I do things. Isn't this how everybody does things? And so I've been really grateful to have people who just go, oh yeah, Bryony, this is why you do that. I do that too. I've been doing it for years. This is how I cope with it. This is how I deal with it. This is how I accommodate myself for this. And so I have this absolute benefit of learning from a lot of different people, and then also reflecting on, I have been accommodating myself for years. I just didn't know that. And so I'm the only time I've ever kind of been really unhappy about this diagnosis is when I was given a book by a psychologist who said, here, read this book. It'll explain ADHD to you. And the person who authored this book spent a large part of the book explaining how hard it is to be in relationship with someone with ADHD. And I came away from reading that book thinking, I am such a burden on everybody who's ever been in relationship with me. And I can feel kind of how that makes me feel emotional right now, because I just wanted to hide myself from the world and hope that nobody would ever see me again, because it was such a harsh perspective written by someone who had several loved ones who had ADHD, two of whom had actually died tragically because of decisions that they made that were very kind of spur of the moment decisions and impulsive decisions. And I mean, some of the reading I've done says that people with ADHD have a higher kind of death and accident rate than neurotypical people. I can understand that from the impulsiveness and the rejection sensitivity dysphoria and all sorts of things. But my overwhelming kind of takeaway from that book was, I'm a burden.
And that is part of the grief process, yeah. Is that you certainly get to see yourself from a different lens. Look, I'm going to be fair here, I think neurodiverse or not, Everybody has to be accommodated in relationships anyway. So I'm just gonna put that out there. But what I'm saying is that the nature of these impairments or difficulties that are put into a book like that can, if you look at them all in one sitting, can be very unpleasant.
Mm.
But the flip side of that is the creativity.
Mm-hmm. The empathy, that comes to
the other side, all the pluses, is they get to live with that as well.
Yeah.
So, and yes, you know, you find, and I'm talking about life partners here or long term friendships. You find people who, you'll find the people that you that don't deplete you are the people that you can just totally be yourself around. Mm. But I really think that we're not unlovable. You know, so, and when something, when it gets put like that into a thing, it can be very, very overwhelming, very dark. I mean, even just as part of the discovery, you realize, oh my word, it must be hard to live with someone who does that or behaves in certain things, in certain ways. But then every human being does and behaves in certain ways that other people have to be willing to
absolutely
compromise on as well. So
we all need to step into each other's shoes. And it's, I mean, the amount of things that, obviously, the algorithms send everything ADHD to me and everything perimenopausal to me. And the amount of posts I see about how to love someone with ADHD, how to love someone who's neurodiverse. And I'm looking for the kind of posts on how to love someone who's neurotypical. It should really just be, how to love someone who's different to you. You just love them. You step into their shoes and you seek to understand them and you embrace the diversity and you look for the commonalities and you find the overlaps in your value systems and how you engage with the world. And that's how to love someone. So yeah, there's lots of things that I find quite frustrating, because there never seems to be the, let's flip this around.
I would venture to say that there needs to be a lot more of this kind of conversation, and there needs to be a lot more normalizing of different ways of thinking. And the more people hear about things that, you know, if you want to call them ways of being that are different, it's about learning the language. The more the, call it, diagnostic criteria are broken down into everyday life experiences and expressed in the world, the more it gets normalized and understood, but also the more compassion there is in the world for accepting one another as we are. So what I have found is in this neurodivergent space is the more you know about it, the more you see it.
Mm.
And I'm so glad there's other people like me that we can support. It's not even to support each other in that, like, we need support, but it's more like celebrating each other. It's totally, I mean, I wouldn't want a world without neurodiverse people. I think it would be sad.
Well, I wouldn't want a world without diversity, full stop. Mm. I think if we were all carbon copies of each other, life would be incredibly boring. And I think for me, that's one of the things that is where I think some of our kind of institutions and organizations and systems and structures are losing their dynamism. In that there's often a call for people to just be these kind of machines, carbon copy of each other, doing things in a precise, systematic way, not using your curiosity and kind of your courage to look at different ways of doing things, to fail fast, to experiment, to try things. It's just, you've got to do things right. You've got to do it right the first time. And so don't be curious. Don't experiment. Don't do anything that might you out the box or rock the boat. And I really do think that we lose a huge amount of value in our communities and organizations and structures because of that. And I look at how so many people are trying to sound like each other and try to jump onto a bandwagon, and how we flood our world with sameness because it's safe, and how that's depleting us of this kind of this richness that gives us the opportunity to thrive and connect and learn from each other and broaden our perspectives and really enrich our relationships.
It's a very different way of seeing the world. It's a sense of being able to, you know, thrive, not despite the ADHD, but because of the ADHD, to actually lean into it once you understand what it is and choose, you know, it speaks to growth mindset and just looking at deciding what you're going to do with some information, is to choose to lean into the positive, find the positive and work with what you have. I think you have to process the dark stuff, the difficult things, but there's no point in staying in that space. It's not going to serve you. But for me, it was critical to go through this journey of understanding what I struggled with, how ADHD presented in my life, because it's different for everybody, which is what's so wild. This is why you and I can have such very different experiences with the same underlying brain wiring, you know? And just understanding that with that, in the space comes a specific degree of creativity, being able to leverage that original thinking, that it brings with it a special type of freedom of thinking and original insights that I wouldn't want to lose for anything in the world. I wouldn't trade my ADHD for anything, because I wouldn't want to give that up either. Another reason I wouldn't take it away for anything is that it made me resilient. It made me resourceful. It made me tenacious, but it just gave me it made me who I am. It fed the way I approach life, and that is still there. And it took me a while to peel back those layers and realize actually, but that the stuff that caused me to burn out is still there, and now I can use those things in a way that I'm much more aware of, and I've learned tools to accommodate myself, that I can go back to being that version of myself. It's a different iteration of the same person. I wouldn't want to go back to my pre-ADHD diagnosis, my pre-perimenopause days. I wouldn't want to go back to that either. This version of me is so much more, she's easier to live with. The voices in my head are definitely not as destructive as they used to be. And Now, I wonder how much of that is, again, it's the hormones, the menopause that just, it softens you. So, you know, maybe in the old days where the prevalence of diagnostics wasn't as common, in one way or another, you have to come to terms with the fact that you're not the person you used to be, and you have to slow down in some ways and be more self-compassionate and play a different role in society, maybe a bit more mentoring now, or the kind of input that you provide changes because you're in a new season.
Which I'm learning to love. I'm learning to embrace the parts of myself that I never really wanted the world to see because I thought they were unacceptable. I'm starting to realize that all of those parts are actually not just acceptable, they're deeply loved by people when I allow them to see those parts of myself. I'm learning to really enjoy letting go and not caring so much about what people think anymore. And it doesn't mean I don't care. I have more capacity to cope with what comes up when somebody says something. And a lot of that, I think, could only have come over the last year, and the burnout, the menopause, the ADHD, all of that has been this perfect storm that I think has given me the opportunity to pause and to reflect on what parts of me got me to the point where everything fell apart. What parts of that were kind of coping mechanisms that I developed to keep myself safe? What part of that collapse was hormonal changes as a result of perimenopause? What part of that triggered this, all the ADHD characteristics and traits to kind of really bubble to the surface? And what do I do with that whole melting pot now? And that for me is this really exciting thing, is that I am so happy to let go of the weight of needing to conform, and in letting go of that weight, there is so much more energy and more creativity and more spontaneity and rest and self-care and personal accommodation and compassion for myself and for others. And yeah, I want to stop there because I can feel my brain is starting to lose its words.
Ways.
Yes. The potato days. might be setting in.
That's hilarious.
What's one thing you wish neurotypical people understood about ADHD? I'll answer that. When I'm interrupting you, I'm not being rude. I'm just so excited about what we're talking about, and there's something I really want to share with you before I forget it. What's your ADHD superpower?
Resilience, determination.
What's your go-to coping trick when your brain's in chaos?
The accommodations that I've learned is to, first of all, identify that my brain is in chaos and give myself enough time to bring it down. If it takes 5 minutes or 10 minutes, step away, allow it to come down, because I know if I extract myself from the situation, it does come down.
Yeah.
But it starts with recognizing it for what it is.
Yeah. It's exactly what I was going to say. Mm. I've got to stop and notice and then just give myself a break from whatever I'm doing. And generally that involves either going for a walk, going to sit outside in the sun if the sun's shining, playing with my dog for a few minutes, or doing something that's non-cognitive. So drawing something, painting something, making something, but completely non-cognitive.
Yeah, that would be helpful. Makes me think of this perception that when something isn't right, when you're feeling like kind of dysregulated, that my sense in that moment is that, and it's not a conscious thing, but it's like my subconscious says this, and it doesn't use the word dysregulation, but that feeling that I have of being out of sorts, It's like my, something in me feels like it's going to be like that forever. That's why I have to catch myself, and I'm only starting to learn this now, catch myself having those feelings and extracting myself from the situation and telling myself, on at least on a verbal level, this is going to pass. This isn't the rest of your life. It's, there's the pluses and the minuses. When you're feeling in that minus, you can't remember what life was like before it, or that it's going to pass. You're just in the space and learning the patterns. And it's like, this will pass, this will pass. And actually embracing that and choosing to extract myself from that moment to begin the process of letting it pass and making it pass. It's something I've had to learn. Whereas I think a lot of people, it comes to naturally. I've had to teach myself that.
Yeah, it's, I think one of my go-to tricks, and it connects to this, is having post-it notes that remind me of this will pass. Love yourself first. This can get done tomorrow too. Whatever it might be. I'm a very visual person, and if I've got it on a post-it note, I think a lot of them have fallen off my screen on my computer. But at one stage, I probably had about 15 post-it notes all kind of pressed to the top of my screen so that I could look at them when I was feeling really dysregulated. Go, oh, yes. If I hadn't seen that, I would have forgotten that.
I think that's the thing, is you do forget.
Yeah.
Your brain, it does. It is a form of daze.
Mm.
It goes into like it's a state where you don't even have words. It's just a feeling.
Yeah.
What I wanted to, the question you asked me just now in terms of what I wish people would know, is that I think what I would like to say, and it's also related to expression, verbalizing, is that there are times that I don't respond and I don't say what I want to say because I haven't had time to think about what I actually want to need. So instead of shooting from the hip and just firing away and making the situation worse, I tend to withdraw so that I don't make it worse. And because I don't trust myself, I can't find the words. And sometimes I need time to process what has happened, to give myself room to understand the situation and what's a healthier response.
Mm.
And in the other person's experience, it might be that I don't care or I'm shutting them out. But it's purely because I don't trust myself with saying what my primal thing, because I know it's going to be hurtful and unhelpful. And I'd rather have time to reflect and react calmly. And by the time, often, I have calmed down and the moment is gone.
What I'm getting from that is, in the impulsiveness of the response, it could come across as hurtful. And when you step away and have time to choose how you want to respond and think it through and find the words and connect them all together in a kind of an elegant, graceful way, then it's a much better opportunity to respond to something.
Or I think I'm not going to be understood.
Yeah.
And it's going to be taken out of context.
So I better not say it.
Just don't. Because I can't always find the words in the heat of the moment.
Yeah.
The words come to me later.
Yeah.
Especially under duress. My brain just freezes. I can't find the right words. And then, so I'd rather just not say anything.
Yeah.
And that's not always helpful in conflict.
Yeah. Something I've learned to do, which I never used to do, is to say, I can't find my words right now, and actually just say it. Because when I stopped speaking, that's when somebody would kind of say, well, are you finished your sentence now? Are you not talking to me anymore? Are we done here? And as you say, the more pressure there is to speak, the less capacity there is to speak. So the only thing I've been able to do is say, I've lost my words. Time out. I'll be back when I find them again.
Yeah. It's that having to put distance between yourself and the emotion.
Yeah.
Before verbalizing a response.
Yeah. What is your ADHD kryptonite?
That actually is a thing. So my ADHD kryptonite is the ADHD itself. It's like, I find it's so cruel. It's like your body and your mind fights its own success. And there are times that I know what's possible and I want to achieve something, but my brain lets me down and I can't do anything about it. It's like my mind self-destructs. So it's like my body prevent me from moving forward, and I have no control over my body creating those things.
Okay.
So it's like the ADHD itself actually is kryptonite for me.
I think my ADHD kryptonite's two things. New things. New technology. New anything that I can zone in on and figure out, does this work better than the other thing that I'm using? So the number of apps and different kind of technological things that I've tried with, invested hours and so much money into, and then realized, no, it doesn't work as well as the other one, and gone back to the first thing that I had. So technology is the one. The other one I would say is hyper-focusing. When I go down a hyper-focus black hole, I can completely lose myself. And it's kryptonite for me because I love the feeling of being in that hyper-focus black hole. It is just, it's like making magic, and I don't want to come out of there. But when I come out of there, I'm completely collapsed and I can't get back in there for days, sometimes weeks.
Did you find that that got worse post the burnout?
The black hole, or the not being able to get back?
Not being able to recover.
Or
taking longer to recover than...
So I don't know if it's taking longer to recover or if it's actually allowing myself to recover. I never allowed myself to have those potato days, which is why I burnt out.
And the thing is that now your body doesn't give you a choice.
No, it doesn't.
And that's why I'm saying it's like once you've had that burnout, that ability to bounce back takes longer.
It was this last burnout where I don't know if I haven't bounced back or if I've decided not to bounce back to what got me into burnout in the first place. Immersing myself in work was 100% my identity. If I couldn't do that, I wasn't anybody. Whereas now I'm starting to realize there are so many parts of me that I want to give space for. So I can't let my identity be working 16 hours a day always. I don't want to bounce back to that.
That reminds me of something that we were saying earlier, and this idea of knowing yourself before and after the diagnosis. And part of my, you call it healing journey over the last few years, is coming, it sounds obvious, but it was an epiphany for me, is coming to a point where I consciously realized that my ADHD doesn't define me.
Mm-hmm.
That was such a liberating realization, where it had been all consuming for the first, when I first got diagnosed, it obsessed me. And once I'd got to a fair amount of healing and understanding of this new world, I realized that actually it's part of me. Mm-hmm. It isn't me. And now, you know, I now carry it around like a handbag. It's part of my being. It's not my entire being. Yeah. So it doesn't inform everything I do, but it is something that does affect me.
Yeah, I get that. It's for me, the kind of the stages in this are pre-ADHD, ADHD diagnosis. ADHD is absolutely everything. I don't want to have ADHD at all. I'm now really curious about it, and I'm starting to understand it. It's less of my vocabulary every more, but I have a bigger vocabulary as a result of it. And I'm hoping at some point I'm going to get to the stage where I don't even think about ADHD. It's not how I label myself anymore. Oh yeah, I forgot I have ADHD. It's just one of those things.
And that's all part of the healing journey, is where you come to a new space.
Yeah.
And you, again, you wouldn't undo it, but it's, you get totally comfortable in your own skin again.
Exactly.
And in fact, you celebrate
aspects. For the first time ever.
this is true. And you come to, instead of, again, judging yourself for now, this weakness, this terribly terrible flaw of fault of a failure of a human being. When you realize, no, actually, this is way more positive than negative. Mm. And
it's for me and for you. I think for some people, I think it comes, possibly not.
Yes, and to be fair, because there are different levels of and degrees of, you know, maybe you need to be very cognizant of that. But certainly my experience has been, it's been enriching. And yeah, I'm really grateful to have had the opportunity to discover it when I did. Mm. I mean, you hear people who only get diagnosed in their 60s. I mean, that wow. must be...
Or never at all.
Never at all. To live with that... And it's also fine, but I think it's just, I'm glad that I learned early enough that I still had enough life in me to come to terms with it, understand it, and now go, like, it's like I'm actually stronger now in some ways because I understand my strengths that I didn't know were there before. I see them better and I can leverage them more efficiently now.
I agree. And I say or never at all for a very specific reason, because I think of all the ways in which I would have continued and perpetuated certain patterns and masking and coping mechanisms for the rest of my life had I not had this diagnosis, and it had kind of stopped me in my tracks and really made me think about who am I now that I know this, and who was I when I didn't know this, and how do I want to show up as a result of this knowledge. So for me, I feel incredible grief for people who never get diagnosed. They never have the language to understand themselves. They keep on perpetuating coping mechanisms, burnout, emotional outbursts, impulsivity, damaged relationships, damaged careers, all sorts of things, because they don't have anything that helps them identify, this is why I do what I do, and I get to choose now to accommodate myself better.
And very often the people around them don't have their language and don't know it either.
Yeah.
I think it's an immensely, it is a great privilege to be able to understand it and have an opportunity to navigate that with a new lens.
I think it's a great privilege to know oneself. Thanks for listening to Lynn and myself talking about our lived experiences of ADHD, what we're learning about ourselves and what we're learning about ourselves through each other. Lynn, thank you. I really appreciate your insights. I think one of the things that I've really gained from you in the last year is this sense of belonging. So I want to thank you for that. And I really appreciate this conversation and for you being on the Eminence Project.
It really has been a lot of fun and liberating in a different way that I couldn't have anticipated. So thank you for this. I really do hope, if nothing else, that someone benefits from this. Thank you.